Welcome to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Over the next hour, you'll be introduced to business and local leaders impacting our community. Text your comments or questions directly to the studio at 540-371-5756 or comment on Facebook at WFVA 1230. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubert.
Great show today. We're going to talk historic preservation in Fredericksburg. A lot, it's a big issue around here, and probably the type of issue that we will talk about many times in the coming years. Michael Spencer is here, associate professor and chair of the Department of Historic Preservation at the University of Mary Washington. Michael, great to have you in. First time you've been in here, and so it's great to meet you and have you come in.
Well, thank you for having me. Really appreciate it.
This is going to be a great show. Also, David James is here, the president of the Historic Fredericksburg Foundation, HFFI. David, good to have you here this morning.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate you very much.
We hear this. This comes up, Michael, in front of city council often, and you hear it in the community. When we talk about this, why should we be concerned with historic preservation?
Well, you're exactly right, Ted. Preservation is an issue that constantly is kind of coming up with city council, planning, Memorials Commission. If you look at minutes, for instance, you'll always see these issues pop up. And I think first, before we even get into why it matters, a little bit of a definition of historic preservation, because I think a lot of people don't have a good understanding of what it actually mm-hmm. is. And so we're really talking about the interpretation and retention of cultural kind of material or material culture. So it's the saving of stuff, right? That's important to understand. It's a little bit different than just the history perspective, which would really focus on the interpretation. Now, why does it matter? I think there are a lot of different reasons out there, and for each person, it's going to be unique. It's going to be kind of distinct. But there's, of course, the argument of quality of life. There is the environmental, and there's the economic. And so when we talk about the quality of life, that's kind of the more traditional argument, mm-hmm. right? So it matters because the culture matters, because saving something helps us understand our place, our sense, our history of a certain area. It provides that identity of a location. So, for instance, Fredericksburg recently had a number of different initiatives, the rebranding effort, for instance. And constantly coming up in conversations was the idea that Fredericksburg was its own entity, that it was historic. And preservation, the saving of that stuff, really gives that identity, not only to the town, but the people who live here. Right, so you identify yourself as from Fredericksburg. And give an illustration of that, about a decade ago, I was walking through the streets of London, and someone came up to me and said, well, you know, how are you doing? Where are you from? You know, we noticed your accent. And I said, Fredericksburg, Virginia. And they said, we know where that is.
Really?
They didn't say Nova. They knew where Fredericksburg was.
Yeah.
Primarily because the Battle of Fredericksburg, right? So that heritage aspect really drew them in, and they understood where I was coming from. And so I think that's an important kind of point to make. I'd also say the economic aspect, and that's one that traditionally preservationists undersell. We talk a lot about the old traditional argument of culture, of heritage, the kind of bleeding heart argument, and that's a big one. But the economic really makes a lot of sense for preservation, and that's things like the expansion of the tax base. So when you enter into a rehabilitation project, your assessed value is going to go up. That generates more money for the locality. And there have been a number of studies in regards to that. So one that I like to bring up from time to time is the 2017 preservation study that talked about 21 cases, rehabilitation projects, and look at their assessed value before rehabilitation and after, and over a 300% increase.
Wow.
That's huge, right? And David James, to my right here with HFFI, of course, he does quite a bit of work with kind of bricks and mortar and rehabilitation type stuff. Probably attest to some of that on the properties that he works with. Of course, there's the heritage tourism aspect, bringing people in, right, to Fredericksburg, not only from international locations, but also kind of national tourism. And again, studies have pinpointed that heritage tourism, the people who do this, tend to be baby boomers, tend to have a little bit more expendable income, and tend to stay longer in locations. So that's something that Fredericksburg really can take advantage of. Property values in general, with historic districts and preservation, tend to maintain their value, tend to hold that value, and tend to weather downturns in the economy better than other mm-hmm. locations. So if you're looking at stability, which sometimes is good in a real estate market, right, if you're not a speculator, preservation is actually a good thing. It really kind of provides consistency to that. Now, we get in discussions about gentrification, which are valid. when we talk about property values, and maybe some other time we should really do that about affordable housing, because it does play a huge role in it. And then, of course, preservation with incubator spaces, the idea that grade A commercial space is expensive, but preservation or historic structure, in a lot of cases, can offer a unique environment for a startup company. I like to tell my students that, you know, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, if they had been on the East Coast in historic cities when they were doing their startups, instead of a garage, it would have been an historic structure.
Yeah.
Because rent values are less for the most part, not all the time, and they're unique spaces.
That's true. And there's also some federal contracting preferences for small businesses for hubs, historically underutilized business zones, in order to increase employment and opportunities in those areas. And in Fredericksburg, those areas are mostly centered around the Mill District and the Darbytown area. So that's a big plus for that sort of thing.
Absolutely. And Mill District has been doing quite a bit of work.
Right, yeah. And that's become just really, you think about it, just a few years ago, it was kind of thought of as a rundown part of town. Now it's very interesting walking through there and looking at that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And some of the proposals, too, I know developer Ed Whalen, a number of years ago now, I think, was looking at development of that space.
Yeah.
And what was really, I think, unique about that approach was looking at affordable housing in conjunction with preservation. So really looking at how we can retain those historic structures in that feel, but also looking at not necessarily $600,000, $800,000 condos or townhomes, but instead things that are more affordable, for people to live and work in Fredericksburg, because we need that. We want that diversity. We want that inclusion.
Yeah, it's such a shame that the Ice House burned down that same complex. So
absolutely.
That was a loss there that I hated to see.
Do you worry, David, when you take a look when we talk about preserving in some of these sites and some of these, when it seems like in Fredericksburg right now, in certain parts of the city, there are more of the condos and the high priced housing. Do you worry that we could lose our character?
With new construction, no. When you take old and revitalize and reuse, the Janie Marshall Building downtown that they're redoing right now.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good example of a reuse, adaptive reuse of a warehouse space that we really need in some cases. So it comes, I guess, to some degree good and bad. It depends on how it's used and how it's sensitively brought into the fold of what we already have.
Well, you're talking, of course, bringing up the case of infill design with new construction. Of course, rehabilitation, fairly straightforward from a preservation approach. With infill design, of course, we do run into potential issues with that in terms of scale and massing. We haven't, these issues aren't new to Fredericksburg. You look back in the 1970s, and everyone can pinpoint to the issue of the Executive Plaza building, right?
Sure.
Or the Big Ugly, as people love to call it. We're talking about issues that come up in a kind of cyclical fashion. Preservation and the ideas haven't changed all that much, but our will to address these issues kind of goes in cycles. And infill design is one of those. And scale and massing is something we should be concerned about in the town or the city of Fredericksburg. If you get too high or we make exceptions and we continue to make those, let's say, zoning exemptions, we do run the risk of having four-story structures next to traditional working class housing might be two stories and maybe only 1,500 square feet. And that then, of course, plays into the gentrification issue and other issues that I was kind of referring to as well. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing about kind of infill design and our guidelines is that a lot of that, the scale and mass and the footprint, are based on quantifiable measures, right? And that's the numeric approach.
Yeah.
Right? So this is stuff that we can actually go and we can measure, and we can make sure that things fit in well in terms of scale and mass. Now, design and aesthetics is another matter, and I know David and I constantly have discussions about that because that is opinion-based. And that, there's some qualitative aspects to it, character-defining features, but there's a lot of wiggle room. With scale and massing, there shouldn't be all that much wiggle room. If it's going to be four stories or 30 feet tall, that's a number.
Yeah.
And we need to really kind of, I think, focus in the future on trying to maintain some of that. And so I do worry from time to time whether that infill is causing harm.
I agree. Locking in a height restriction, for one. I mean, it is a constant battle to keep the buildings to something that is historically sensitive to what we already have. And 50 feet is gracious plenty, in my humble opinion.
Yeah.
We are talking historic preservation this morning. We need to take a quick break. Michael Spencer is here from UMW. David James is here from HFFI. More on News Talk 1230 WFVA. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Got a question for today's guest? Text the studio now at 540-371-5756. Here's the host of Town Talk, Ted Shoup.
Historic preservation, our focus this morning. David James here from the Historic Fredericksburg Foundation. Michael Spencer is here. He's a professor in the historic preservation area at UMW. As we got going here and talked about caring about preservation, I guess the other things that we did not talk about is you talked about quality of life and economic and so on. There's also an environmental aspect to all of this.
Absolutely. And that's, again, another one of those, along with economic, that we tend to not touch on it. I won't say it's a recent argument from a preservation perspective, but it's one that we've kind of missed. And it's a great fit for what we do. There's that green aspect. And it stems from everything from the walkability of historic communities. So not needing to get into your car, right? Sure. You walk downtown. And Fredericksburg is well positioned with this. I mean, I look at towns like Charlottesville, I grew up, my parents live. And yes, they've got the pedestrian mall, but the proximity to residential neighborhoods isn't quite there.
Yeah.
Here in Fredericksburg, we've got the ability to walk from a residential neighborhood, lots of people living, directly to the historic district where there's a lot of kind of commerce, there are businesses, there are restaurants to go to. So,
and the trails network with the canal and all that?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And so really, getting out of the car and walking it is really important. And with some of the parking, I won't even bring up parking, I probably shouldn't, but some of the stuff that, you know, they're doing with parking, again, there's going to be a little bit more available for people to park and walk. And I think that's an important point to make from preservation standpoint. There are also some of the more technical matters as well. So, for instance, the idea of embodied energy, that when you build a structure, you've invested that energy. And when you tear it down, you lose that energy, right? So if we tear something down to build new, it's almost a double whammy, right? So you're taking that energy away that you invested in the historic structure, and now you're adding energy to the new one that you're building. And so, you know, that's a big thing that we want to address or we want to bring up when we talk preservation. And Carl LaFont, there's a great quote that he did, I think, around 2005 or so, but and others have said it in similar fashion, but the greenest building is the one already built.
True.
So again, you've got an inherent environmental aspect with that. One of the illustrations I've used in class from time to time, about 10 years ago, was the whole Seco-Beck debate at University of Mary Washington, tearing that structure down. And we talked about the historic aspect of it, right, why it was significant. And one of the points we also started to make was, hey, this is a 42,000 square foot structure.
Yeah.
It's huge, right? So what's the embodied energy? What's the environmental kind of impact if we tear that down? And so using some of Donovan Ripkema, who's a great kind of economist, but also does place economics out of D.C., he did some studies, threw together some stats. And so using some baseline information here, what I was looking at was this 42,000 square foot structure equates to 14.1 million aluminum cans. Now, I come from the age where you used to collect aluminum cans and recycle, right? And I think some people are familiar with that. If we look at one can per student a day, that's 4,000 UMW students, right? Recycling, it would have taken 16.8 years to recoup the embodied energy lost if we had torn down Seco-Beck Hall. And then I showed a graphic of the aluminum cans in volume, right? This big block on campus. This is huge. This is monstrous. It dwarfs any structure. And so the idea is that if you keep these structures, if you put them to new uses, rehabilitation, you can save a lot in terms of environmental cost. It also plays into what we call life cycle analysis. And that's the idea. And this is the big one that's somewhat controversial in the sense that there's a lot of things that go into this, but also the window debate. Should I replace my windows or should I keep my historic windows?
Yeah.
And the concept here is that historic materials typically are high quality and if well maintained, and they tend to be pretty simple too, if well maintained, will last 200, 300 years. That requires some painting, some scraping, some elbow.
And they can be repaired, whereas modern ones cannot.
Absolutely, right? If you break a window today and it's a double insulated, right, you're talking about an entire replacement. If you break a window pane in a historic structure, you go down to White's Glass, you buy a piece of glass for, $10 cut, and you install it, you're done in 2 hours. If you're really bad at it, you're done in 4 hours. But
interesting.
You're able to do it yourself.
Yeah.
And so with the life cycle analysis, that kind of gets at the point where, okay, you've got this wood window. You've invested the energy of it. It'll last 200 years with minimal kind of effort to, you know, a large degree. If you buy a new replacement window, let's see the gasket on that, right? It's a double pane. It's got a gasket. That gasket's going to fail after 20 years max, 25, 30. If it's a really high quality window, window will fog, complete replacement. So any energy you saved by getting that new window, is it going to be made up in the 3, 4, 5 times you replace it during the duration of, say, the wood window and how long that would last? And that's that kind of life cycle analysis, things that you need to consider when you talk about it. So is the savings really worth it? Yes, there are savings to new windows, sure, but they don't necessarily negate taking out your old and replacing with new. And then, of course, there are all sorts of retrofits you can do. Storm windows, right? Drapes, actually, right, prevent drafting and other things like that. But, of course, it's our culture, right, perpetuated by a lot of the home kind of stores, right, that sell their wares, right? The one kind of example I use sometimes was this Phantom Songs, you have to tear it down to make it beautiful, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the home improvement commercial that used that. And sledgehammer knocking out plaster walls, and I'm cringing looking at the TV because that's just a destruction, right, and not necessarily needed. And, of course, from the energy standpoint, such a waste environmentally. There's also the idea of waste in the landfills, right? So this is a loose stat, but 30% of our landfill is construction debris. And you can go to, was it King George, where they've got the big landfill, right? Mm-hmm. I think they still maybe give tours, but you can kind of see how they break things up. But construction debris is a large part of that. And so if you save the building, you reduce that waste. And so really, pro-preservation is pro-environment. And that's a big point to make from a preservation standpoint.
Interesting. You're right that to be pro environment, anti preservation. I hadn't thought about those two and how they are kind of related.
Yeah, and it's an argument too. You know, you're in a coffee shop and you talk about it. People kind of say, "Wow, you know, hey, this makes sense from a green perspective." And in fact, you know, if you look at things that you can do to better the environment, preservation is right on up there with driving electric cars and other things, right? In fact, in a lot of cases, it supersedes that. And you're doing it just by keeping something, right?
Sure.
So actually, by spending less money, saving money, you're actually bettering the environment, right? You're not buying that new window.
Good point.
Well, when we talk about this, Michael Spencer here from UMW, David James from HFFI, as we talk historic preservation this morning on News Talk 1230 WFVA. And we're just going to get started here. We're going to have to take a break, but I'll wind you both up on this. Is this the type of thing where you're going to have developers and planners always at odds when we talk about this issue?
Well, and if you're talking about in terms of preservation, right, so are preservationists always contrary to development? And the answer is no. We used to, at the University of Kentucky when I taught there, would talk about how preservation is a means to really stop bad design and bad infill. But it's not there to limit that, right? Hmm. So it's supposed to be something that helps you create something that's going to better that environment and add to which is the kind of legacy of a town or a location. Preservationists love infill. Build up, not out, right, is one of the mantras that we kind of toss around from time to time. But we really, really don't like bad design. And that goes in scale, massing, but also design that's unsympathetic to the character of locations, right? And so an architect should not be designing in a vacuum. They should be designing in a context,
yeah,
right? And so if there's that open lot, they need to look at the adjacent structures. They need to see the style. They need to do things like that and apply it to their design. Not that it has to mimic. We don't want it to mimic. We want that layered history, but it needs to respect it. And that's something where if we kind of get into the kind of next aspect of preservation in Fredericksburg here, where we stand with things, that's one of the kind of issues that we're facing, I think. We talked briefly at the beginning about infill design, scale massing, yep, issues there. And again, losing the historic character of Fredericksburg dovetails right into that and is one of a number of issues that we're facing. Not insurmountable issues, but issues. And of course, there are always going to be issues that pop up. I do want to make a kind of distinction, though, before we kind of launch into that, and maybe this is kind of a good thing to bring up before the next break. The distinction
between different kind of preservation.
Different groups? Kind of preservation, absolutely. David, you want
to? Oh, well, there are certain folks that are focused on the preservation of historic documents and things. The Rappahannock Area Heritage Center is a perfect example of that. And then you've got museum-type folks that are focused on the museum and the stuff like the James Madison Law Library.
Mm-hmm. James Monroe.
And the one that you...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So Washington Heritage Museums, right. My executive director, Ann Darren, on here, I think, fairly often.
Yeah.
But, you know, so museums in Fredericksburg, FAM, right, Fredericksburg Area Museum, with Sarah Poor, Washington Heritage Museums,
awesome
George Washington Foundation, you know, are all doing an amazing job. Central Rappahannock Heritage Center, Virginia Honor Room, it's the archives, it's the museums. These are things that we as a city recognize. We see that as the kind of face of preservation, and we're all on board, right?
Yep.
Yeah, they've got some. They continue to need support, but people see it as a real positive. The issue is when we start to get to preservation advocacy, which tends to be one of the really big parts of preservation because it looks at the town as an aggregate. If you've got two or three buildings that are saved, that's great, but doesn't necessarily provide that ambiance to Fredericksburg that we want in terms of the historic character, right? That name or that association as the most historic town in Fredericksburg, right? Which started in the 1920s as a kind of a ploy to get people in here. But, you know, the idea is that we need people to save their privately owned structures. We need folks who have property downtown to help preserve their commercial establishments, because if we lose that, we lose that aggregate character of the town. And HFFI, Historic Fredericksburg Foundation Incorporated, which David is president of, is the really sole advocacy group that does that. I was approached a few weeks ago, someone asking me, who do I need to contact to help us, you know, lobby for preservation efforts in Fredericksburg, right? Who do I need to contact? I said, well, you just pick up the phone and call HFFI because there is no one else in town. And I don't mean that as a negative. But when you're with a museum, you tend not to want to engage in those confrontational aspects. You've got people who donate. You've got a mission that is really kept on track, and it should be that way. And so that advocacy is usually not part of it unless it's for that distinct structure or archive. And so HFFI fills that role, a very necessary role, but one that I would say is extremely underappreciated. And in fact, is one that if you know we're going to highlight what's so important is really – really what HFI does. And they engage in things like helping or trying to advocate for issues like demolition by neglect. And David, I know this is one of your big issues.
Before I get you wound up on that, David, we're going to take a break.
All right.
And then we're going to take off on that when we come back, because that is such a such a big thing. And we'll get into that when we come back in just a second. Michael Spencer here with the UMW. He's with the Department of Historic Preservation. David James here with the Historic Fredericksburg Foundation. More on News Talk 1230 WFVA. It's 8:31.
Okay, listen, we got to talk about something.
Talk done right. News Talk 1230 WFVA Fredericksburg, a Centennial Broadcasting Station. This is Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. Now, the host of Town Talk, Ted Schubert.
Great stuff this morning. Historic preservation, our focus. David James is here, the president of Historic Fredericksburg Foundation. Before we get out of here this morning, we'll talk about how you can get involved and help out HFFI. And Michael Spencer is an associate professor in the Department of Historic Preservation at the University of Mary Washington. Before we jump into demolition by neglect, David, I thought we would go back, just take a step back and talk about the role that HFFI and the Architectural Review Board that we often hear about in the city plays. Is the ARB sort of the policing agency of a lot of these things?
Yes, they are. And HFFI is basically a watchdog organization that looks at the ARB's processes and supports, or in some cases, agrees to disagree. So, you know, a lot of times HFFI is identified with ARB and vice versa. ARB is a regulatory organization within the city that decides what or doesn't go forward on different designs. And it's seen by some as a violation of property rights. And I think we need to think of the ARB as something kind of akin to a subdivision homeowners association.
Yeah.
Some people see a HOA as a violation of property rights. So if you want to live free of those conditions, live in an area without subdivision restrictions and covenants. My brother is very, very happy in Alaska. He literally has 17 plus cars and trucks in various stages of restoration parked all around his yard, and he's very, very happy. And try that in a local subdivision. That's not going to work. If you like a true subdivision, and many people do, you know, I appreciate that, you know, go live in what I call Barbie and Ken world and be happy if that's what you want to live. But if you live in a designated historic district, then there needs to be certain rules and restrictions to abide by, governed by the ARB, using the Secretary of Interior standards. It's fairly simple. It's not a big of a deal. And there are times that the developers and development-minded staff and officials are at odds. Sure, it happens. But we're not the enemy of that sort of a planning and developing process. But the ARB, following the Secretary's Interior standards, dictates what you cannot develop within your historic properties. It dictates that it can be done in a sensitive way and does not destroy the historic nature of the building, but it doesn't mean you can't develop your properties. You can. That's the reason it's there. HFFI is the only local preservation group that advocates for preservation of historic properties, and that's our main mission in life. We quietly work, carry a big stick, we pick and choose our battles, we maintain over 40 preservation easements, and we try hard to solve the issues at the lowest level possible. And most times we're successful, but not always. And if pushed, we will take a case to court if necessary. We simply maintain that what is old and should be maintained in place. By that we mean using the Secretary of Interior standards for historic preservation, which is the guiding principle to be used by the ARB. We follow their cases, indicate our concerns, and we are a watchdog organization willing to go to bat if necessary. So,
has it gotten tougher for you in recent years, or is it about the same?
It's always a juggling match, and there are different things that come up at different times. Some things motivate folks more than others. When you take a historic property that is well-known and well-liked, then it becomes a flash moment. And at other times, it just kind of goes on and on and on without a whole lot of a wrinkle.
And it seems, David, as though that you would rather work behind the scenes with someone and try to come up with some kind of an agreement than to make it, have it blow up into some kind of big issue.
We do try very hard to solve issues at the lowest possible level. I go to property owners myself, if necessary, talk to them about our concerns. With easements, try to talk to them in advance. We hold the easements for preservation easements that have been given to us by prior owners. Most times, it were buildings that HFFI bought, refurbished, rehabbed ourselves, and then resold with environmental preservation easements on top of them. And then we follow those easements to make sure they're being followed and adhered to. So in other cases, it's simply a matter of talking to the property owner and saying, hey, have you seen this window that's in such bad shape, or the roof that's holed, but the squirrels coming in and out of on the right-hand side? It's just taking care of maintenance is it's a segue into what I really want to talk about.
And just one thing to add to that, if I might, communication, right? Addressing these things up front, as David alludes to, is so important. It's not the big, scary architectural review board or HFFI that's out to get you.
Mm-hmm.
The idea is that you live downtown, you're within the H1 overlay of the historic district, which is an ordinance. Right?
Yeah.
It's got some legal teeth to it. You're abiding by these rules, but if you address it before you kind of hire the architect and get your plans out there, you're going to save everybody a lot of time and a lot of headache.
Uh-huh.
And things will be much more fluid in the process. So I just wanted to mention that communication, education, and getting up front is extremely important, rather than presenting before the ARB and being declined because you didn't do your homework. And that's where the frustration, I think, boils over in a lot of cases.
Yep. So, you know, property's being maintained. It, to my mind, and I'm sick and tired, and I'm not going to take it anymore, and I'm hoping that other people in Fredericksburg feel the same way, but demolition by neglect, that little buzzword, demolition by neglect, it is the reason that I agreed to become the president for HFFI, Historic Fredericksburg Foundation Incorporated. My main goal as president is to find some way to stop this needless demolition of historic properties. And it goes back, I've lived in Fredericksburg my entire life. I grew up in Lower Caroline Street. I live on the same block I grew up on. I went to school here. I've been 35 plus years in the real estate related fields, the real estate broker and real estate associated work. And I've done 29 years in the National Guard as a combat engineer soldier. But all my time has been here in Fredericksburg. As the president, I started a list of historic properties that we have lost since HFFI was first formed in 1953. And I'm not sure it's all inclusive, but there's been at least 50 properties, not all of which are what I would deem as historically significant. And my take on what makes a property historically significant is, could HFFI galvanize the community into action? For example, in the last 10 years, by my count, we have lost 12 or more properties. In the last 10 years, there are only three that I think that, given enough time, we might have saved. And they are the Fredericksburg Hardware, established in 1849.
Mm-hmm.
It was lost in 2011. 1407 Caroline Street, that's Danny Mitchell's old house, and that was the 1700s, 1780s. Lost that in 2012. And 401/403 Sophia Street, and that was an 1843 antebellum property that we lost in 2015. So those are three what I consider to be significant properties that we've lost. So I'm sure you're asking yourself, how did we fail that as a community? Personally, I think we all need to take some of the responsibility for loss. I know you're thinking, why? The first step to stopping demolition by neglect is simply maintenance. We're all responsible for our own homes, but if you see a crime, do you feel a responsibility to report it? I know. Let me get my thought out. I was a co-president for the Darbytown Civic Association. We identified the top three at-risk properties, and we talked to landowners, kind of similar to what I do now as the Historic Fredericksburg Foundation, tried to get them to figure out a way to maintain the properties. The good news story is that all three properties have been saved right now. And we each have a responsibility to speak out and at the very least report it to the city. If you search the city's website for property maintenance, you will find that the city has adopted Part 3 of the Virginia Maintenance Code of the Virginia Uniform Statewide Building Code. It has minimum standards and regulations. They have enforced this code since 1987. The city even has a contact form for preservation maintenance to report issues, so it's not hard. But it's obvious that they need our help. Their inspections are for structural soundness, overall condition, are the broken windows, unsafe doors, stairs, and looking at the code itself, there are is the property in good repair, structurally sound, roofs and drains, roof and flashing shall be sound, tight, no defects that admit rain, quote unquote. That's part of the code. So my next question is, how did we almost lose the Beanery? And if y'all know what I'm talking about, the Beanery is on Frederick Street across from the Purina Tower.
Yeah.
And Hamilton Palmer and I went to the Architects for You board years ago and pleaded with them to allow us, the Darbytown Civic Association at that time, to replace the roof. And the city staff would not allow the temporary use of what could be considered a permanent solution. I can appreciate and form what they're talking about, but it didn't allow us to save the structure or at least the interior stuff. The good news is the property is now taken care of. I feel like Mike Adams with his project and the is doing a great job, and it's looking great, a little higher than I would like, but it is a nice property. My point is, this would not have happened if the maintenance code was enforced. We all bear that responsibility, not just the city. If a property tips too far from lack of maintenance, it's lost. Or is it? The maintenance code gives us a clue of another step we might take to stave off demolition by neglect. It says, in addition, historic buildings may be prevented by authority granted to the local historic review boards. In our case, that's the ARB. So how did we lose the three historic properties I talked about earlier? Fredericksburg Hardware's demolition was approved by the ARB. Okay, that's understandable. It went through the process. But how did 1407 Caroline Street, the 1780s property, or 401 and 403 Sophia Street get torn down without ARB approval? Well, I can tell you, if the building code official determines that it is a threat to the public, then they can and did issue a demo permit with the building being torn down. This is the dirty little secret, is if you can convince the building code official that the building is a threat to the public, then you can bypass the ARB's review of the demolition plan and destroy the property. That's my understanding of what happened to 1407 Caroline Street and 401 and 403 Sophia Street. The ARB approved the demolition of the 1940s addition, but then bypassed the ARB, and the property owner did, by convincing the building code official that it was in danger to the a danger to the public.
And David, if I can just kind of add into that, because that's a great point to make. In most cases, or a lot of cases, building code officials aren't necessarily going in and looking at the structural integrity of the building.
Mm-hmm.
This is an aesthetic application, right? So I walk by and I see your building in poor condition, meaning the paint might be flaking off or there might be things growing out of the gutter. Again, the case is being made, that's a health, safety, welfare issue, whereas the actual structural system of that building might be perfectly sound, but yet demolition occurs. And so therein lies a big problem, a sticky wicket in the code enforcement and how we move forward with things.
I'm glad you asked that question, because there's a little notice paragraph in the maintenance code, and it reads, and it seems innocuous. I mean, you look at it, and you're like, okay, so what? But closing of streets when necessary for public safety. Let me read that again. Closing of streets when necessary for public safety. And it's not just streets. The code official shall be permitted to order the temporary closing of sidewalks, premises adjacent to unsafe or unfit structures to and prohibit the use of such spaces. Now, what does that do? Well, that takes away the threat to the public. So if you take away the threat to the public by finding a way of closing off access, then the threat goes away to the public, and we go through the ARB process like we normally would. That needs to be put into the city's processes of how they deal with properties that are under threat of demolition. It's not there right now. If we, the city of Fredericksburg, had done that, we would still have both of these historic structures. The ARB could have been given the chance to speak, and HFI, if necessary, would have had the opportunity to take either case to court, providing it could prove that it has standing. And that is an entirely different subject, but I'll get off my soapbox.
Well, right now, just I'll kind of add to that, too. So, you know, there's definitely the stick approach, right, with some of the enforcement.
Oh, yeah.
There are issues with enforcement, but there's also a little bit of a carrot thing. And one of the things that constantly comes up is lack of incentives to do this, right? We give incentives all across the board to different entities out there. But in preservation, you've got tax credits from a kind of a federal level or state level. They're intensive, right? Yeah, you can recoup up to 45% if you've got a commercial structure that you're rehabbing, and it qualifies. But still, you have to go through all that paperwork. And locally, right, we've got the Fredericksburg Local Rehabilitation Tax Exemption Program. That's a mouthful. And again, it's not well understood in Fredericksburg, and so people aren't aware that some of these things exist. And that's a residential commercial incentive, again, over 7 years in terms of your tax liability on the property. I think the first 2 years, 100% forgiven on that. But again, incentives, the lack of those, but also not making those widespread or the knowledge on how to use those has become an issue in terms of some of the demolition that occurs with historic structures. And, you know, sometimes you hear that, oh, if I had only known. But in that case, too, it's an educational issue.
Yeah.
We need
to
get out in front of this, and we need to help people, you know, kind of navigate through a lot of these aspects.
We can take a quick break. We're going to wrap this up. Michael Spencer is here, an associate professor in the Department of Historic Preservation at University of Mary Washington. David James with Historic Fredericksburg Foundation. We'll talk about how you can get involved with HFFI, too, before we get out of here this morning. More on News Talk 1230 WFE. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFEA. You can weigh in about today's Town Talk topic on Facebook at WFEA 1230. Now, your host, Ted Shuler.
Historic preservation this morning. Michael Spencer and David James here as we talk about this in the city of Fredericksburg. It's not all doom and gloom, I guess, Mike.
Not all doom and gloom, but before I kind of broach that subject, I did want to give a quick kind of shout out to my 4-year-old daughter, make her day, Estella. I hope you're doing well and getting ready for school today. So anyway, good morning. Not all doom and gloom. That's exactly right. So the city of Fredericksburg has been making progress over the years. One of the big things that happened in 2016 was the hiring of Kate Schwartz. Those of you who are familiar with preservation know her as kind of the preservation planner in town. That was a big move forward in terms of the city. The city's also looking at developing this, really has developed an archaeology ordinance, which is looking at getting funding in fiscal year 2022. Get my dates correct here. So that's a kind of a big step forward. Working on a new preservation plan, working on a new historic district handbook, and even addressing some of the racial inequalities in terms of the interpretation of our history here in Fredericksburg as well through the Memorials Commission, the hiring of Sites of Consciousness, and again, some of the great work that's being done by city staff in that respect. Also, University of Mary Washington, give a plug for my department here. We're constantly engaged in the community, whether it's through volunteering with various boards like the Washington Heritage Museums or Fredericksburg Area Museum, doing workshops from mortar repointing to helping College Heights understand its historic material, its historic structures, and its design. And of course, classes, right? Constantly have the students out and about in Fredericksburg. You can see them with those yellow cases walking around town. And I know HFFI is also doing quite a bit to kind of help preservation in Fredericksburg.
Oh, sure. Recently, we had our 50th annual Candlelight Tour, which was a success thanks to Leslie Pugh and company. We hope to have many events this year, as in the past, mostly produced by Barbara Anderson, depending on the COVID statistics moving forward. Events like Pints for Preservation, Prohibition Tour, Warehouse Walking Tour, Coffee for Conservation, and lots more, hopefully. We've also had the Renwick Lecture Series with Danae Peckler chaired, speaking of which, we continue to work with the city to designate the courthouse as a National Historic Landmark. Danae has the PIF preliminary information form filled out, and we got that process started. She leads the real estate committee and is historic property advocacy for our 40-plus historic easements. Ed Santner looks in depth at our area and at-risk properties. Sue Stone with the marker committee continues to churn out markers. Our oral history committee, chaired by Elizabeth Daly. Education research, Nancy Moore. Scott Walker is working on funding streams while my wife, Terry, is the treasurer, and she tries to save us money. Helen Ross keeps us in line with our policies and procedures, and we hope fairly soon to open up a freshly painted and revitalized Lewis store as a representation of what the store might have looked like back in the 1700s and use it as a tourist attraction.
That's
great.
We've
got a lot going on.
Yeah, you certainly do. And again, that's right across from the library downtown. If I want to get involved with HFFI, how do I do that?
Well, we've got a new director. She's Gretchen Pendleton, and she's available. And her phone number is 371-4504. We've always looking for volunteers. And if you have an interest in actual historic preservation, property preservation, and advocacy, please call our director.
And it's fun. It's fun to do.
Well, and you both are so involved in the community. Michael, you're involved, I know, with Washington Heritage Museums and do a lot there, and just great organizations between the two. And you're involved in this. This is more than just an academic exercise this morning about talking about this. This is where you live, and this is what you breathe and what you love.
Absolutely, and you just get really involved in Fredericksburg. I mean, the town's the size that you can become part of these committees, part of these organizations, and really have a pretty profound impact.
Well, it is. I should have had you two in long ago, and we're going to take care of that and continue this discussion. And as topics come up, because they always do, as things come up, we will do this frequently and continue a lot of issues we didn't talk about this
Absolutely.
Morning that we will continue to do. Thanks both of you for what you do, because it's great stuff, and to have you here and to be able to talk about this, we will. This is one of these to be continued shows.
Absolutely, tip of the iceberg here.
Michael Spencer is the associate professor in the Department of Historic Preservation at the University of Mary Washington, David James with Historic Fredericksburg Foundation. That's it for Town Talk. Thank you for listening this morning. We will stay safe. We'll see you Monday on News Talk 1230 WFVA.
Thanks for listening to Town Talk on News Talk 1230 WFVA. The views expressed by the host and guests on this program are their own and not necessarily those of this station, its management, or Centennial Broadcasting. The Glenn Beck program is next on News Talk 1230 WFVA.